WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's frightening to think how adjusted we've become to stepping around people living on city streets, men and women whose only home is a cardboard box or a dirty wet blanket. More and more people are becoming homeless, and we don't seem to be any closer to reversing this dehumanizing trend. My guest Joel Blau is a former policy analyst for the New York City agency which runs the homeless shelters for the city's single adults. He was sure the city was taking the wrong approach to homelessness, so he quit. He says myths about the homeless are leading to misguided policies. He hopes to dispel some of those myths in his new book. Blau is now an assistant professor at the School of Social Welfare at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. His new book is called The Visible Poor. And it's certainly true that with the homeless camped out in the streets, poverty is no longer hidden in America.
People, at least in the 1980s, didn't want to be bothered with any evidence that Reagan economics was not working the way President Reagan and Republican domestic policy people said it was. We were in the full flush of what was supposed to be an economic boom, and any evidence on the street of people who were so desperately poor that they had to exhibit their poverty in public was very unseemly and disorienting. It went against everything we were told in the media. Poverty that people see makes passersby very uncomfortable. And I think that accounts for a lot of the power of homelessness as a social issue, because it creates all sorts of feelings in people, the feeling of failure, of contempt for the failure, the feeling of the inadequacy of my giving a quarter or 50 cents or a dollar, the feeling of there but for the grace of God go I. And I suggest in the book that it's the power of these emotions that frame the social policies that we have developed. And I would argue that most of the social policies have targeted not the real causes of homelessness, but getting the homeless off the streets and out of public view.
You want your book to dispel some myths about who is homeless today. Let's start with the fact that you think that the proportion of the mentally ill homeless has been exaggerated according to the research you've done.
That's right. The proportions have been exaggerated for a number of reasons. First of all, to start with the issue of deinstitutionalization as a cause, two-thirds of the people in mental hospitals in this country were deinstitutionalized by 1972. Therefore, it's impossible to ascribe to deinstitutionalization the proliferation of homelessness 10 years later. Secondly, there is this whole issue of how the mental health field goes about diagnosing people and labeling them mentally ill. I'll give you a couple of examples. First of all, according to the prime reference book of the American Psychiatric Association, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the way where most diagnoses come from, if you eat out of a garbage can, you are a schizophrenic. That is, you have one of the residual symptoms of schizophrenia. Now, a psychiatrist might look at that and with tunnel vision say, that person eating out of the garbage can is schizophrenic. A sociologist might look at that same person and say, perhaps that person is hungry. So that unless these labels are used with some sensitivity to the social context in which they're being employed, what you get is a psychiatrization of an entire population. And the same thing is true. There's also a diagnosis in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual called antisocial personality disorder. Antisocial personality disorder has one of its prime attributes, not having an address for 1 month or more, which most homeless people would immediately qualify merely by being homeless. So you have this commingling of what I would argue are primarily economic factors with a whole series of psychological factors. And the result is that an entire class of people have been labeled as dysfunctional psychiatrically dysfunctional in a way that I don't think takes into account the economic damage that has been done to them merely by their status of being homeless.
Well, what you're saying isn't to make light of the number of people who are mentally ill and homeless. What percentage would you say they probably make up of the homeless population?
Well, I would say that about 25 to 30% of the population is emotionally disturbed. But once again, I would caution to be very careful in analyzing what the relationship is between those kinds of diagnoses and the economic and effects of their status as being homeless people.
Another myth that you want to dispel is that drugs and alcohol are primary causes of homelessness. They're not?
Well, I think there are symptoms of homelessness. In the early part of the 20th century, the temperance movement tried to argue that if poor people were not subject to alcohol and didn't drink so much, they would no longer be poor. I think poor people were poor in the turn of the century and, you know, ethnic communities, industrial working people, because they weren't paid enough. And they drank because it was social and it helped to ease the pain. I think someday we'll come to look upon the notion that drugs or mental illness caused homelessness as another example of a longstanding American tradition of using a defect to explain, personal defect to explain the spread of poverty.
You're in fact suspicious of some uses of demographic data about the homeless population. What are your concerns?
My concerns are that on the one hand, demographic data is very useful for designing programs. It makes a big difference whether homeless people are people who've recently lost their jobs or people who are primarily mentally ill. But beyond that point of some kind of basic characterizations, we tend in this country to be almost obsessional about getting the last number and getting the last category correct, you know, down to the last person. And I think this is part of the American tradition to try to explain away structural problems. If people are poor, that's must because they are different from us. And if we do the demographic analysis, then we can find out in what way they are different from us. If we can find out that there's a high prevalence of mental illness, then, well, we're not mentally ill. That must be the explanation why they're homeless. If they have drugs, well, we don't use drugs. Therefore, that must be the explanation of why they're homeless. And that has a longstanding tradition in it. And it concerns me because my basic feeling is that people have common human needs and homelessness is a consequence of things that have happened to them which have more to do with political and economic causes than they do with another set of social problems that have become commingled with those political and economic causes, such as lack of money and things like that.
You think that it's very important to understand the causes of homelessness in order to be able to solve the problem of homelessness. You have what I thought was a very interesting analysis of our philosophy of welfare. What you say in your book basically is that the philosophy in the United States of welfare is that welfare has to pay less than a job would. And lately, welfare has paid so little that it's not enough to rent a house or to rent an apartment with.
Yeah, the principle that I describe in the book is what we, you know, what people talk about all the time. They say things like, well, you know, work has to pay more than welfare or why would anyone bother to work? What happened, I think, over the last 15 years is that as wages have either held constant or declined, in order to keep welfare below the lower rung of wages, welfare has gone down too. So that, for example, the median state in this country, Illinois, lost 42% of the value of its welfare grant between 1970 and 1991, so that welfare grant, I think, pays like $367 a month for three people, a mother and two children. And there's no way you can sustain yourself on that kind of money in Illinois. And it's one of the reasons why people are really suffering. If wages go down and welfare goes down and housing goes up, you're left with an affordability gap that is, in my judgment, the prime reason why so many people have become homeless.
So you think the prime reasons for homelessness are is unemployment, low wages, low welfare, and hard-to-find low-rent housing?
That's right. Now, everything that people often mistake, in my view, for the real causes, such as the drugs and the mental illness, then get overlaid onto that. And sometimes it's hard to distinguish a symptom from a cause, but I would say that those are really symptoms and not causes.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Joel Blau. He's an assistant professor at the School of Social Welfare at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and author of a new book about homelessness. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Joel Blau is my guest. He's author of the new book, The Visible Poor. It's about homelessness in America. Do you think that in trying to find solutions to homelessness in America, we have created some solutions that have really made the problem worse?
Yes. Rather than provide permanent housing, we would waste and have wasted thousands of dollars a month on major welfare hotels and family shelters in most American cities. Rather than provide people with real jobs that pay real wages, we have wasted money on all sorts of temporary provisions for income. We need a program in this country that really makes people productive, that enables them to support a family, and enables them to have the social supports they need when they have trouble. And all of us, at some time or another in our lives, are going to have difficulty about something, whether it's an illness or a loss of a job, whatever it is.
What would you address first, the lack of short-term shelter space or the social and economic problems that lay behind homelessness?
I hope I don't have to choose.
Right.
Well, I think the first thing I would do, I would hope, would be to ensure that there was permanent shelter. And
as opposed to temporary shelter.
As opposed to temporary shelter. I think we need a program of a nonprofit permanent housing in this country, which would not be subject to real estate appreciation, so that if you got a house and stayed in it and then left, that would be returned to the nonprofit community agency that owned it, and that you couldn't resell it for a profit. That seems to me the best way to create a social sector for housing. On the longer term kinds of policies, we need the usual shopping list. It's things like national health insurance, the provision of daycare so that people can work, wages that are large enough to support a family. We've shortchanged the entire American population terribly about these needs over the last 10 or 15 years.
You know, I have to compliment you in talking about the kind of housing you'd like to see. You use the phrase nonprofit permanent housing, thus very cleverly getting around the expression public housing.
Well, of course it is. I mean, public housing
has a terrible reputation.
Has a terrible reputation, and it was, I think, inevitable that it gained such a reputation because the same principle that applies to the labor market, where welfare has to pay less than work, also applies to public housing. You could not build attractive public housing in this country because that would intrude upon what is thought of as a prerogative of the real estate market, namely the real estate industry, namely to create private housing for profit. If you did a really successful, attractive public housing project and didn't have a need standard to get in there, people would say, well, why can't we have that? So I think that it was set up so that housing for the poor would necessarily be poor housing. And when I say nonprofit social sector for housing, I mean something that would not have a means test, that would be available to everybody, and that would, in fact, be something that the ordinary working person would be perfectly happy to live in.
Now, you said that cheap housing should be available without having to prove financial need. But I think some people would argue that people who might want to save money but could afford better would use this housing, and since the units are limited, that would be depriving people who couldn't possibly afford better of using this housing.
What I'm talking about is the creation of a social sector which doesn't make distinctions between who needs it and who doesn't. For example, in England before Thatcher, public housing was simply public housing. It was another, you know, there was private housing and there was public housing. You could try to get an apartment in one kind of housing or try to get an apartment in another without having to prove that you lacked sufficient income. The issue that you're raising is an important one in the sense that there's always a trade-off between the adequacy of universal programs for everybody and targeted programs that are based on a means test or lacking a certain level of income. And I'm suggesting that what we need to do in the housing field is provide housing that's for everybody, and then we won't have to make the distinctions about whether somebody is sufficiently desperate.
One of the changes we saw in a lot of cities in the 70s and 80s was gentrification that basically got rid of the Skid Row areas of cities, the areas in which there were really cheap hotels, flop houses, cheap housing. What impact do you think that that's had on the larger problem of homelessness? Has it been very significant?
It's been of enormous significance. The effect of this, some million units of SRO housing across the country in from 1970 into the early 80s has been considerable. The fact is that the casual laborers, the people who were vulnerable, who were housed in places that charge relatively small amounts per month, no longer have a place to go. And they constitute a significant part of the population.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joel Blau, and he's the author of a new book on homelessness in America called The Visible Poor. You used to be a policy advisor to the part of the city that oversaw shelters in New York. And you've seen a lot of the shelters in New York. You've also, I believe, traveled around the country and visited a lot of shelters there. Can you give me an example of what you've seen of a shelter that epitomizes what's wrong with the shelter system? And then maybe one that is a very good example of one of the best shelters you've seen.
Well, the worst shelters are probably the large armories in New York, for example, the Fort Washington Armory in New York, which is two football fields long. It was used for the National Guard to train. And if you stand on the balcony above the drill floor, you can see two football fields of cots laid side by side, 900, sometimes as many as 1,200 people. The same dynamics that occur in any institution that is that large occur in a shelter of that sort. Drugs begin to proliferate. People become hopeless. There's crime. There's violence. It's a terrible way to house people, and one that's absolutely certain to increase the difficulties of the homeless problem. The best shelters, I'm not sure that I could think of one in a specific place, but they tend to be smaller. 25 people, I think, is sort of the best judgment about how large you can get without beginning to precipitate some of the dynamics of a large institution. They have social services in the shelter, a job training program and referrals in the shelter. I think, some shelters in Los Angeles that do that. There are some smaller voluntary shelters that do that, but there are few and far between.
I wonder if you think any of the presidential candidates are saying anything of substance about homelessness.
I don't think so. I thought that Harkin would, but I think what most of them have decided tactically is that they should talk about the middle class rather than the poor. The 84 and 88 elections were conducted about the poor, and they were lost. And so I think people, the presidential candidates, have decided to focus on the middle class. And I think that the Democratic Party needs to walk on two legs. It needs to try to develop a coalition of both poor and middle class people organized around common human needs through universal social programs, and that those are the the programs and those are the ways, and that's the coalition that will return a progressive Democrat to the White House.
You know, in some perverse way, one good thing about how visible the homeless are, how many homeless are living in the streets of the cities, is that it makes it a middle class issue. Because people going to work, people living in the city, no matter how wealthy they are, have to deal with homelessness. And it's everybody's issue because of that.
That's right. I mean, I think that part of the 1980s, people believed that they could get wealthy and they could have their sort of castle and moat mentality. You know, you could hole yourself up in a luxury building in the central city, and while it's true you might have to step over a few bodies on the way to work, that somehow you would be immune from what was going on around you. And I think that what's happened over the last couple of years, particularly with the recession, is it's demonstrated that what happened in the 80s disguised changes in income with an enormous shift of income upward, and that in some sense homelessness in the 1970s or early 80s is sort of the modern equivalent of Song of the Canary in the mines, where if the canary dies and the miners know they're in trouble because the gas is loose, the fact that homeless people were out on the street is a sign, was the first sign, I would argue, of a decline in our standard of living, because poor people used to be housed even if they were poor. Now poor people are homeless, and as their standard of living has declined, I would argue people good ways up the income scale, their standard of living has declined as well.
Well, Joel Blau, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joel Blau is the author of the new book, The Visible Poor. It's about homelessness in America, and it's just been published by Oxford University Press. Blau is an assistant professor at the School of Social Welfare at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.